when you have a paleo diet, you really have two levels of structure. And the one level of structure is called macrostructure, which is simply the particle size distribution of the feed that you give the birds. So that's the macrostructure. And obviously, as we all know, this is important for feed intake. While the microstructure is a completely different type of structure, because this is really that particle distribution of the dissolved pellets once they have been eaten. And they dissolve in the crop and the gizzard. Then you have, the pellets consist of some particles. So there's simply the distribution of size of those particles.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Kemin invites you to optimize animal feed quality and safety with our portfolio of solutions. Learn more at Kemin.com/AG. Evonik, we are sciencing the global food challenge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of the Feed Science Podcast Show, brought to you on behalf of Wisenetics. I am Wilmer Pacheco. I am an associate professor in the Department of Poultry Science at Auburn University. We are dedicated to bringing you the latest insights and discussions in the feed industry. Get ready to expand your knowledge and stay ahead with today's episode. And today I have the pleasure of having as a guest Dr. Birger Svihus from the Norwegian University of Life Science in Norway. And Dr. Svihus is an expert in poultry nutrition and feed processing. Hello, Dr. Svihus. How are you doing?
Hello, Wilmer. I'm doing fine. Thanks for the invitation.
Well, thank you for accepting and being part again of this podcast. And, we have had the opportunity to interact many times in conferences, and we have had the opportunity to have you here in Auburn last year. But for the ones that don't know you, could you share some insights about your professional experience?
Sure. Well, mainly it's poultry nutrition and a lot about broilers, to be honest. In addition, I've been particularly interested in, I would say, carbohydrates, both the fiber and the starch, and on the other hand, digestive functionality, understanding the digestive process and how that interacts also with the processing of feed, the particle size, the structure, but also the heat treatment. And generally, feed processing has been something I've been moving into. So I guess that covers my interest in different directions that I've followed by more or less by coincidence, but it's been really exciting and fun.
Yes, and I still remember that when I was a grad student back in 2008, I was working a lot in particle size, and I used to read a lot of your very interesting reviews. And, in previous podcasts, you have discussed the importance of the microstructure, the macrostructure of the feed and the microstructure. And I would like to know, how do you define those two, different structures of pelleted diets?
Yeah, and as you know, Wilma, since you're a co-author, We are now soon finishing a manuscript that we will submit, hopefully will be accepted, where we discuss this in great detail. So I think that the insights are hopefully increasing with time and with the work that we put into this. And this structure, the reason why I coined the term micro and macrostructure a few years ago is that I think it's important when you have a pelleted diet, you really have two levels of structure. And the one level of structure is called macrostructure, which is simply the particle size distribution of the feed that you give the birds. I mean, so it's very easy to measure. I mean, it's really just sieve the feed through a series of sieves, and then you will know the the sizes and the particle distribution of the particles that you give to the bird. So that's the macrostructure. And obviously, as we all know, this is important for feed intake. While the microstructure is a completely different type of structure, because this is really that particle distribution of the dissolved pellets once they have been eaten. And they dissolve in the crop and the gizzard. Then you have, the pellets consist of some particles. So there's simply the distribution of size of those particles. But this is much more complicated to measure. This is a big challenge. We don't really have very easy methods to measure this. It's not technically very difficult, although there are challenges, but it's laborious. You need to dissolve the feed, the pelleted feed in something, and then you have to wash this through or somehow, measure the particle size distribution. And then there is all kinds of questions arising about swelling and disintegration and all kinds of things. But anyway, it's basically how you measure it. It's by wet sieving, various methods of wet sieving. And this is the microstructure is important for the extremely important topic of stimulating digestive function. This is actually what led me into the interest in structure and led me into the interest in the digestive tract, because when I started working on this in the early 1990s, looking at how these microstructure or the particles that the pellet consists of stimulate the gizzard, and by stimulating the gizzard, improves performance of the bird and makes them more robust and healthy. This is how I got into the whole thing about all these things that I'm now still finding very interesting. So micro and macrostructure, this is what they are. The one, macrostructure defining have a large impact on feed intake, while microstructure mainly a way of making sure that the gizzard is stimulated and digestive function is working well. And of course, some grinding there must be, because there is a limit to how much coarse particles the birds can handle.
Yeah, and when we discuss macrostructure, and you have done some research, and other research have also shown that in reality, during the first week, birds can tolerate a higher level of fines. And when we define fines, we typically define with particles smaller than 1 millimeter. And during the starter periods, and then during the grow out, grower and finisher periods, they can tolerate higher pellet sizes. And I know that you have been doing some research in those areas. Could you share the findings?
Yeah, because now we are really talking about the macrostructure, the actual structure of the feed, the pelleted diets. And to start with the starter diets, what we basically have as kind of a very specific recommendation is Aviagen's recommendation. And I think it's a very good attempt to try to define it based on the knowledge we have. But I think that we need more research to test specifically what the requirement is. So I think that this is a kind of best effort to try to come up with something that seems to work. But for the starter diet, after doing experiments with the starter phase and experiencing how broad particle size distribution can be for starters, and also observing that they really eat the fines. And I've come to the conclusion when it comes to starter diets that crumbling, I think, is generally a good idea, and we don't need to worry too much about the fines. It is fine with some fines. The big question is, of course, how much fines? Possibly there is a maximum, but there's been many papers, particularly in the US, published showing a rather high amounts of fines showing that the birds are able to tolerate the fines.
I think, you know, what you're discussing is very important because even, you know, in my own experience, some feed mills that repelled the fines on crumble diets, they just repelled those fines many times. So you end up with a really good crumble size, but then the feed could be, you know, some of the nutrients in that feed could be damaged due to, you know, excessive heat treatment.
Exactly. And we did a very small observational study, hasn't been published, at least not yet. But what we did actually from day old, this was observational. It was a pilot study, I would say. From day old, we gave the broiler chickens access to 5 different feeders placed in the pen, and with for each pen, each feeder, we had a different particle size. We had smaller than 1.6 millimeter. We had 1.6 millimeter to 2.8 millimeter. We had 2.8 to 4. 4 to 4.8 and larger than 4.8 because we used a 5 millimeter pellet. I think if this was 5, this is what we used. And so the birds could choose. They could eat exactly what they wanted. The performance was excellent in the birds. They were growing extremely well. And guess what they actually preferred the first 10 days of those particles?
The intermediate, I will imagine, 2.8.
You should think so, but the amazing thing, and every day the feeders were replaced in different places, and you know always made sure there was all the feeds were present and so forth, but they actually preferred the particles smaller than 1.6 millimeter. It was amazing. It's like 50% of what they ate. You know, remember they could choose, they could get exactly what they want. They wanted to eat the fines. It was very surprising. This was just one observational study. It needs to be repeated in a more with more replication, but it supports conclusions we've made from more published studies with the starter diet, where we by using a crumble 5 millimeter starter pellet. We saw that the birds were actually eating all particle sizes, including larger than 4 millimeter. Mm-hmm. We talk about 5-day-old broiler chickens. They were eating. We did the same experiment there. Again, they were able to choose which particles they wanted to eat. And the difference in consumption of the larger than 4 millimeter and the 2.8 to 4 was not large. Mm-hmm. And the finds also very little variation in what they were eating. They seem to be generally more robust than we have thought. And I guess that it makes makes sense because remember that the day-old chickens, they are not resting. They don't spend so much of their time resting. They're more agile. They move more around. Yeah. The requirement for eating compared to the time they're willing to stand is much better. The ratio is much better than later. At later ages, you know, they get up to using 80% of the time resting. Right, so they are of course heavier. They're more lazy. I mean, it requires more to stand up. So then structure and too much fines becomes a more critical matter. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I think in the starter phase, my thinking now is that we should be the least worried with fines in the starter diets. Of course, if it's only, you know, fine powder, we know it doesn't work.
Yes.
So there must be some larger particles to stimulate the feed intake, but they also will eat the fines.
And, you know, like now that we are discussing macrostructure during that starter phase, Do you have any preferences between, or what will be your suggestion for the industry between using crumbles or micro pellets? Because you also have seen that, you know, a good segment of the industry also likes micro pellets.
Obviously, crumbles. I don't believe in micro pellets at all. I mean, mainly because it requires a lot of effort to pellet those diets. And when you do that, you use a lot of energy and you may overheat the pellet, destroying enzymes, destroying vitamins. Maybe in a European setting, you know, you can also risk a too hard pellet that they don't want to eat. It's actually a very common problem here in Europe where we use such a lot of wheat that the pellet is actually becoming too hard. They just throw it around instead of eating it and they waste a lot of feed. I know that's not necessarily a big problem in the US with your maize-based diets, but still, I now think that we can maybe just use one pelletize, and then we can crumble that pellet, let's say a 5 millimeter or 4.8, which is not too uncommon use in the US, you understand, but crumble that 4.8 millimeter pellet for the starter, and then move to pellets. Because this is what we did in several experiments we've been carrying out. We, at 10 days of age, we have shifted to 5 millimeter diameter pellets, 6 millimeter long, and very high durability, typical European wheat-based diet. So very hard, durable pellets, not a lot of fines. And they are perfectly able to eat such a large pellet from 10 days of age.
Yeah, and I also agree with you, Dr. Zvihos, because in my opinion, like you're saying it, when we make these micro pellets, we just lose a lot of, throughput in the pellet mill. But the other thing that is important, I think, to remember is that when we make those micro pellets, we also need to grind finer.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly.
And then we lose also microstructure, the distribution of those particles in those micro pellets. So there will be less GISAR stimulation and less reverse peristalsis.
Exactly. And this is also a very important motivation for me to try to encourage the industry to use larger diameter. Maybe that is not so important in the US because you generally use a larger diameter of your pellets here in US and also in Latin America, I think. But in Europe, the tendency is that the feed millers, they want to use 3 millimeter pellets, 3.5 millimeter pellet, at the maximum 4 millimeter pellets. And I think we can go larger. And then we go larger. I think there's a potential for a win-win-win situation. You get coarser microstructure, and you get at least as good feed intake, and you save energy and the processing.
Yes.
So I think that's a potentially win-win-win situation. And when we now know that they are able to handle larger particles than what is indicated in the Aviagen recommendations, for example, we should go larger. And this is also what we discussed in this review that, you know, we are now writing. And we also when you realize how the bird will eat particles, you realize the potential of increasing particle size, because they are actually picking one particle at a time, each peck one particle, at least when there are particular matter in the dead. So if you increase the size of the particle, it's to the double. And their pecking rate is quite stable, about one peck per second. And when you increase the size of each particle they eat for each peck, you increase the feed intake capacity per time unit. You can easily double it. So I think we should push size of the pellet to the maximum that the birds can handle. And then I think there's a potential for pushing that more.
Yes, yes, and I did make some calculations between like 3 millimeter pellets and 4.4 millimeter pellets, and just by increasing the diameter, you, like you're saying, you double the volume of a pellet.
Yeah, exactly, or more actually.
Yeah, so birds can consume faster, particularly as they are getting older, and particularly we are producing. You know, like birds that we are going to debone later. So birds that are, we are growing more than, you know, let's say 49 days of age. But, you know, one thing that I see as a challenge in the industry is that, you know, like at the exit of the pellet die, there are knives that we can use to cut the pellets at different lengths. That's a challenge that typically I see because they don't cut, they just, they don't use the knives, but I think also using the knives to control the length of the pellets, they can do faster transitions from crumbles to pellets. Because I have seen some, you know, scenarios where we are feeding crumbles more than 20 days, just because there is that fear that birds are going to reject, you know, big diameters and long pellets. But that could be fixed just by controlling the pellet length easily.
Exactly. And you can actually produce almost some kind of crumble by keeping the knife very close to the die, let's say 3 millimeter or 2 millimeter. You actually, and we've done that in experiments, you get something that resembles actually crumbles, but we haven't tested it in feeding experiments, but absolutely. And we also tested, when we tested this 5 millimeter pellet from 10 days of age, we also did increase the length by increasing the distance between knife and die to 10 millimeter. Mm-hmm. So we had 5 millimeter diameter pellets, 10 millimeter long. When you look at the picture of that compared to a 6 millimeter, 3 millimeter pellets, you can see that how much larger they are. And we were really worried, you know, will the bird starve to death, you know, when they would switch suddenly at 10 days, but they were perfectly fine with that large size.
Yeah.
They are more generally, my thinking now, based on what we have observed in many experiments, is that the broilers are more robust than we thought. Maybe particularly the modern breeds, which have been bred to have a high capacity to eat and a high appetite, maybe don't need to worry so much. But of course, the other side of the coin, the backside of the coin or something like that, is of course that there is a risk that you will have a lower durability of the pellet when you increase the diameter. So you have to be a little bit careful, because if the compaction and the binding in the pellet becomes too weak, so it simply disintegrates completely, then you're back to mash. So, and we know that mash, you will not have the same feed intake. There's a limit to how much they can manage. They will, even modern broilers will grow 10-15% slower if you don't pellet. I think that's a kind of rule of thumb. So there's a limit. So, and you have to manage to balance that sufficient amount of coarse particles and not too much fines, so that you still have a maximized feed intake.
Well, you know, that's microstructure, and it's very important what you are mentioning, that we should challenge those birds, you know, to eat larger pellets, because that's going to make them consume, you know, they feed faster, and then there is going to be less competition for feeder space, which can also influence the uniformity of the flock positively. What about microstructure? What are your thoughts? Because, you know, like in Europe, some companies use whole wheat in the diet. I have seen some research using whole sorghum. In the US, we use coarse, you know, corn. So, in your opinion, what are the minimum levels of coarse particles that birds need to, you know, stimulate gastrointestinal function?
That's a good question, and it's not a question where I think it's possible to come with a definite answer. I have We see that if you go from, first of all, I think that particles somewhere between need to be larger than somewhere between 1 and 2 millimeter in order to really have a strong stimulating effect on the gizzard. So ideally, I mean, I think that ideally we should have some particles larger than 2 millimeter in diameter in the microstructure. And you will get that if you have a very coarse grinding, for example, use a hammer mill and 8 or 9 millimeter diameter holes in the screen, you will get a significant amount of particles larger than 2 millimeter. And we've seen that going from, let's say, only 5% particles larger than 2 millimeter to 15-20% particles larger than 2 millimeter, you can see significantly more muscular gizzard. So you see that it's stimulated, which I think is good. It supports the normal functionality of the gizzard. But whether particles also between 1 and 2 millimeter stimulate the gizzard is not 100% sure. But I've made myself a rule of thumb, which is more or less, if you need to make a conclusion, I would say that, you know, maybe if you manage to get approaching 20% particles larger than 2 millimeter in the diet, 40% particles larger than 1 millimeter, I think that's then you have a sufficient structure for a very well developed digestive tract and a good functionality of the gizzard. That's what I would say.
You know, I do remember maybe like a few years back, we already published that research trial, but we were working with different grind sizes, 750, 1150, and 1550 microns. And we were feeding those ones in mesh, 4 millimeter pellets and 3 millimeter pellets. And the part that it was extremely interesting was that when we were grinding 750, with 3 millimeter pellets, all the birds have issues with gizzard and proventriculus development.
Oh, really?
It's very, very interesting, that interaction between grind size and also pellet size. And what you were discussing, you know, like a few minutes ago, of grinding too fine and then making a small pellets really hard. It seems like that's the perfect combination to have, you know, gastrointestinal issues in.
Absolutely. And I think also day-old broiler chickens should have some, they should start to stimulate the gizzard early. I think that would be very good. So, and also when I'm saying, let's say 20% particles larger than 2 millimeter, it's not easy when you're going to pellet because the pellet press, as we know, is also a grinder. It tends to destroy the core structure, and it destroys it more when the diameter of the pellet is smaller. So that's another issue. But, you know, there's a potential great win-win here because, you know, very coarse grinding, same energy. Large pellet diameter, same energy. And at the end, hopefully, ideally, a diet that's actually cheaper but better. So, there should be some, I think there's some potential here at least to twist processing in that direction.
Yeah, it is true. Because, you know, like if you are grinding fine and then you are using micro pellets or small pellets, let's say if you are spending $5 extra per ton of feed, you need to, I don't think that you can get back that money in performance, because actually what the research shows is that the performance is going to either be equal or is going to go down as you reduce the particle size too much, or if you reduce the diameter of those pellets too much.
Yeah.
But, you know, one thing that probably I need to ask, you know, directly is like, in your opinion, what is more important, macrostructure or microstructure?
I think in Europe, there has been a lot of focus on microstructure. Everybody understands the importance of microstructure now, which is really good. And you see some traveling around Europe and countries like Bulgaria, for example, where I was last fall and with the feed mill, they really had understood the importance of coarse grinding. It was a very nice structure of both the mash layer diets and the pelleted broiler diets. So I think that it's very well understood, very well accepted. But now I think the macrostructure and the pellet size is kind of the next question, where we are. We have been thinking that we shouldn't go larger than 3, 3.5, 4 millimeter in diameter, maximum diameter. And we've been thinking that this is too big for the birds, I think. And then we've been too concerned that it will reduce the pellet durability. Honestly, in Europe, I think we have too good pellet durability. I think the problem in Europe is rather too good pellet durability than too poor. We tend to use a lot of energy in the pelleting process. Sometimes the temperature goes too high because some feed millers are not sufficiently conscious about the importance of post-pellet temperature. They don't measure post-pellet temperature, for example. And then by using a thick dye and a thin diameter and wheat-based diets, you know, they are pushing things through. I've seen feed millers that have used the rolls, they push them towards the dye. And the dye is like, it's, I mean, it's completely worn after a very short time because of the, they do that, and actually they have to do it to be able to press this very sticky material through these very long and very thin holes. So I think we pushed it too far. This is why I usually say when I talk with European, we should learn from America on this matter, because I know you're bolder, you're going a little bit higher in diameter.
Yeah, and basically, I mean, it's different approach because, like, if you go U.S. and Latin America, the focus is more like, in U.S. is more like conditioning temperature, 88 Celsius degrees or 190 Fahrenheit with dyes that have a compression ratio of 11 to 12. If you go to Latin America, it will be, you know, conditioning temperatures of 82 to 85, but thicker dyes. So it's very interesting, you know, how like different regions approach, you know, strategies to improve the durability of the pellets in different ways. In my opinion, you know, like the industry has so many tools now because you can change, you know, conditioning temperatures, you can change retention time, you can change the amount of fat in the mixer. So probably, you know, like the right answer is in the middle, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, maybe it is. In Europe, you know, very common, it's 75 degrees Celsius conditioning temperature, so very low conditioning temperature, and they therefore use the pellet press, mechanical energy for heating. Mm-hmm. I think that we should go a little bit, I don't know, you know, maybe the as always, the golden middle way, but at least increase the conditioning temperature. It should be cheaper to heat the material by steam than by mechanical energy. Increasing, and I think that's why the Americans do it, but I'm not sure, but I guess they've done the math. Of course, it's also a matter of electricity prices and gas prices and a lot of factors playing in here, but that's what it's all about, right? But increasing the conditioning temperature and then using a thinner dye and a larger diameter, you can achieve the same, but potentially in a better way.
Yeah, and you know, like something that comes to my mind too, I don't know really well the feed mills in Europe. In the US, we don't add any water in the mixer. And I'm not sure if in Europe or other regions they use water. And sometimes, you know, feed mills use that water to compensate for the losses during the storage and during grinding. But when we add water in the mixer, then we have the capacity to add more steam in the conditioner. So, I mean, there are different balances there. My advice always is, if you are adding 1% water in the mixer, add it with something else, with a surfactant, with a mold inhibitor, with something to control salmonella. But if you are adding 1%, just add 0.5% instead, and add 7 extra, you know, Celsius degrees in the conditioner in a way that helps you to improve pellet quality. But there might be some differences in water addition, you know, in the system too.
Yeah, I know in Europe, at least some feed mills I've visited, they actually add water, but they add water to adjust for variations in the dry matter content in different ingredients, which is, I think, is a very good idea, because you have to understand. I mean, if you want us to keep control of a stable pellet, mm-hmm. durability, for example, I mean, if the maize is 13% moisture compared to 10,
yeah,
it is a different material. The grinding is different, but also the conditioning and pelting factor. So to adjust for these things is a good idea. And some do it automatically, I think. That's what I've heard, which is a very fascinating technology. Can potentially have a very stable pelting when raw materials change.
Yeah. What I have seen is that, you know, some companies have like a moisture analyzer inside the mixer. And then they just fix, you know, the amount of moisture leaving that mixer to, let's say, 12.5 or 12.8. Yeah. And depending on the moisture content, then the system adds different levels of moisture to the fascia. It's a good idea.
Yeah, it is. Then you don't need to, then you can keep the conditioning the same, and you should have more a stable and similar durability of the diet all the time. Because that's also something we know that generally changes. It's not good. I mean, but the birds get used to some kind of structure. They sometimes hesitate if the structure changes, mm-hmm. and that gives them a kind of they lose momentum a little bit.
Also, because the diets are changing, right? The levels of corn and soybean meal and other ingredients is going to be changing depending on the phases. So, yeah, I think it is a good idea, you know, like to balance that moisture.
It's time for our famous three.
But, you know, like Dr. Esvijos, just to, I think this has been like a really good conversation, and we could speak for hours.
Yeah, good.
But just to finalize, I would like to maybe get your opinion on what advice would you give to students listening to this podcast on how they can prepare better for a successful career in the animal and feed industry. I know that, you know, several students like to listen to this podcast, and I always like to provide some advice to them.
Well, I mean, first of all, congratulations in choosing a very, very important topic. Of utmost importance for the well-being of mankind. And what would we be without food? And animal products are a very important, essential part of it. So motivation, I mean, and this should be a good motivation for doing a good job, because it's easy to see the importance of what we're doing. Beside, I think that I would say that, you know, the basics. Make sure you understand the basics. I mean, don't think that basic nutrition or basic chemistry even is a waste of time. I think that a good knowledge-based foundation is very important. And if you don't see it, you will see it later, right? If you don't see it while you study it, you will see it later, because it helps you reason. And that's the other thing. You know, always, you know, to reason, to train your ability to reason, to analytical thinking, you know, is actually very important. And by doing that, you can really make changes, and it's more fun to learn, and you can actually, you know, really make a significant contribution by just thinking So it's not only about practical solutions, well, of course, which is also about thinking, but it's also about the creative mind, to nurture the creative mind and be driven by curiosity. It's really a very, then everything is fun, right? Then it's fun to study, it's fun to work. You know, when you are curious, when you always think about, can this be done better, you know? And when you study, you ask questions while you study, you have an active relationship with whatever you're doing intellectually. So I don't know if that was an advice or what it was, but I think that it will help if you manage to do that. It will be a good advice. And then, of course, meeting people, taking part in activities where you meet people, interact with your lecturer and with others and with the industry. Of course, if you want to land a good job, it's always very appreciated to take initiative, right? Mm-hmm. You approach people. You know, don't be afraid, but don't be passive. Be proactive, as we say.
Well, you know, like as you were speaking, I was thinking that, you know, like science is likely like music, right? As you learn the lyrics, you enjoy the song more.
Yeah, exactly. It's true.
It's important to be curious. Yeah,
and it is a very it's a multidimensional matrix of things you need to combine in order to be a good nutritionist. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the challenge of trying to find the compromise between a lot of interests, as we've been talking about in this podcast, yeah. You know, to find a balance between sometimes conflicting interests, yeah. Mm-hmm. Macrostructure, microstructure, right? And to find a way requires that you understand all the factors that are relevant.
Yes, yes.
And you think about it.
Well, you know, that concludes another episode of the Feed Science Podcast Show presented by Wisenetics. Thank you for joining us today. Don't forget to subscribe to stay updated on future episodes. And if you enjoyed this episode, please leave us your comments. Thank you, Dr. Svihus. And I hope everyone have a blessed day.
Thank you, Dr. Pacheco.
Thank you.
Nice to talk with you.
Thank you.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.